Today is Tuesday, March 27th. We're going to work more today on digestive system information.
Okay, so let's talk about what this curve represents. This curve represents the affinity between oxygen and what? Hemoglobin, good. And the curve actually here is kind of an S-shaped curve, and that's because oxygen and hemoglobin like each other. And the curve helps us predict under what conditions might they break up or might they stay together. So there's three curves for us to look at. There's a normal curve that runs along the middle here. That's normal body temperature, normal pH, and normal CO2 levels. In order to shift the curve off to the right, there would have to be some changes in those conditions. So what would happen to body temp to shift us to the right?
Increase,
good. How about, say, CO2 levels?
Increase,
and blood pH will then
decrease.
So we're looking at acidosis causing a shift off here to the right. So when we use that right shift, we know that there's a higher likelihood of oxygen and hemoglobin staying together or breaking up. So if you shift to the right, you're increasing the chance of having oxygen and hemoglobin break up. Okay, so the shift to the right means that we're going to decrease saturation, and that's because oxygen and hemoglobin break apart or dissociate. Okay, so let me repeat that. That shift to the right will be encouraged if you're hot, say due to fever or exercise. It may be due to increased CO2. That again could be due to exercise. Or then, of course, if you increase CO2, you will decrease blood pH. So acidosis can also increase the likelihood of oxygen and hemoglobin breaking up, which we call dissociation. All right, so what might encourage oxygen and hemoglobin to stay bound to each other and shift this graph to the left?
Colder temperature and higher pH.
Good. Colder temperature and higher pH. Likewise, we expect CO2 levels, they may in fact be
lower.
Yep. So we're looking at those three conditions being a leading, kind of a guide to shifting us to the left. Now, if you do shift to the left, what happens to oxygen and hemoglobin?
They stay together.
They stay together. So if it's cold, they snuggle up, they stay bound together. And what happens to your saturation?
Increases,
right. So oxygen and hemoglobin stay together. You know, that's the reason behind why when you're cold, your extremities turn blue. You know, we're sending that oxygen to the hemoglobin. We're letting it circulate around to the vital organs rather than letting it diffuse out to our cells and tissues. You know, we don't want to give it away to our fingers and toes. We only give the oxygen away to where it matters, and that's those vital organs. Okay, so that's kind of the history behind this thing. We know that we have a normal line in the middle. We have a right shift line, which means that we're hot, we're in acidosis, we're looking at excess CO2. That encourages oxygen and hemoglobin to dissociate. They break up. Likewise, a shift to the left here means that oxygen and hemoglobin are more likely to stay together. Right, so we are less likely to dissociate those two. And what happens to your saturation when you shift left?
Increases,
right. Okay, so that's kind of the background story for this. Let's talk about some numbers. If you're looking at, say, a PO2 of 60, that's our partial pressure, what would you estimate our saturation if you're looking at everything normal? Okay, so which line are you going to go to?
The blue one.
Go to the blue one. Up just a bit right there.
Close to
85, 86, 87, somewhere in that neighborhood. Okay. Let's do this. Let's say that you're exercising, you're still at 60 millimeters mercury pressure, but you know, because we're exercising, body temperature heats up. So now where do you shift to? Shift right, good. And what do you expect to happen with the percent saturation?
Decrease
it, yeah. So there you go. You're looking at lower 80s, right? So it validates what we expect, that when you're hot, when you're exercising, that oxygen and hemoglobin, they break up. So where does oxygen go? When they break up, it goes to the tissues, good, to make ATP. Yeah, so there's a reason for the breakup. It's that we're using it to make ATP. Okay, let's do another one. Let's say that our PO2, that looks like what, maybe 41 or 42 down here at the x-axis. Okay, let's say that this time we are dealing with cold temperatures. Which line should we use? Good, and what do you estimate our saturation to be? I'm hearing lower 80s, okay, so like 82, something like that. So it's kind of interesting that even at a lower PO2, you're still at the same saturation than if you were at, you know, something like 60 for partial pressure. So it really kind of gives us a good idea how cold temperatures can increase our percent saturation. A couple of things you want to feel comfortable with for test day. If I gave you a chart like this and I said my PO2 is 60 and I'm everything normal, could you read it and tell me what your value is? Okay, if I said my PO2 is 60 and I'm hot or I'm cold, could you also read it and tell me?
Yeah.
Okay, that's your comfort level for this, okay? If I said to you my PO2 is 60 and I'm hot or I'm cold, could you tell me what happens to our percent saturation?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what you want to be able to do come test day, okay? There were some practice problems on the bottom of page 79. Why don't I post those answers for you on D2L? And then if you check it and you're not comfortable, let me know and we'll go over those specific ones in class. Okay. Since we're on respiratory, is there anything else while we're here you want to talk about? Okay, I'll bug you again Thursday. Let me know Thursday if there's something you want to hit. All right, so let's see. We were in class last Thursday talking about the mouth. That was actually page 84 in chapter 22. That was page 84. So one of our last topics in here was to talk about salivary glands, which happen to be an accessory gland for our mouth. And the catch is salivary glands make saliva and put that saliva into the mouth to help moisten our food, also to make sure that we don't have dental cavities because it keeps bacteria from growing on our teeth. So if you happen to have a viral infection called the mumps tend to set up residency and cause inflammation in those salivary glands. You can see how swollen this kid's face is. You know, they're actually finding that as we get older, we need a booster shot. And so you may have had an MMR vaccine as a very little one, and then probably around age 11 or 12, you probably had another MMR booster. So they find that our immune systems really don't stay beefed up against measles, mumps, and rubella like they should. That's why they tend to get that booster shot. So unfortunately, there's a bad side effect of the mumps. In addition to causing swelling in the salivary glands in males, they can cause sterility because of the inflammation in the testes. So that's certainly a reason why they want to push having that vaccine for mumps to avoid that particular issue. Let's see. I believe we were near the bottom of that page. Let's talk about mouth functions down there. So fancy language for eating is to ingest food. So ingestion is simply eating. Mastication is how we chew food. That tears our food particles from big pieces into smaller, more manageable pieces. And really the only chemical breakdown that we do here is using which enzyme? Good. And what does that break down? Good. Starch into sugars. Okay. All right, so you would actually have to hold a piece of starchy food like bread or potato chips in your mouth for around 20 minutes to have full conversion of starch into sugar. I mean, as an adult, I don't know if I'm up for that. You know, if you're 5 years old, you know, you can probably walk around and chew something and not even have any problem with sucking on like nasty chewed up bread. But as an adult, it would take at least 20 minutes to get that food conversion from a starch to the simple sugar. My point is, obviously, the mouth is not going to finish the job of breaking down starches into sugars. We're going to have to leave that for the small intestine. So none of us are willing to chew food for that length of time. All right, so let me take you over to the top of page 85. Did you have any questions on the mouth, page 84? We know from the respiratory system there are three parts to the pharynx. The upper region, called the nasopharynx, sits up above the soft palate, and that's not going to be part of our story today. It is only a passageway for what? For air, right. So we're not going to bother with nasopharynx today. We are going to then focus on oropharynx behind the mouth and the laryngopharynx down below, because they are home to some tonsils. Which tonsils are set up in your oropharynx region? Palatine and lingual. Good. We know that those tonsils have lymphocytes in there. They help to combat bacteria, viruses, entering through both our nose and our mouth cavities. By the time we get down to the laryngopharynx, we are now looking at a place where our body decides how to route food and air. There is a flap that covers over your trachea and prevents you from aspiring air, pollen, keeps you from aspiring food down into your trachea. What is the name of that flap?
Epiglottis.
Good. So we think of the laryngopharynx as a routing point. Air goes into the trachea, food and drink go down the esophagus. Which of those tubes is posterior?
Esophagus.
Good. Okay. So let me flip settings here.
Okay, I just want you to look straight ahead at the wall and say candy, candy, candy. Great. I'm going to give you the cup. This is a barium liquid. I just want you to take one sip and swallow.
So it goes through these blackout spells, but it's pretty cool to watch.
Great. Just take a couple sips in a row like you're thirsty.
And okay. You can see the epiglottis. Let's see if it comes back.
All right, I'm going to give you a teaspoon of some pudding. I want you to swallow that when you're ready.
So this is pudding. There's the epiglottis sitting way up there.
Okay. I'm going to give you your nuts. Let's chew that up and swallow.
You see the epiglottis kind of flapping right there.
Okay. Do you feel like everything's going down, or do you feel it stuck?
Not really.
Where is it stuck? Can you point to it?
Like
right there. Okay. Just want to see if there's anything still.
Now, I want you
can
to
you
see
point
the front
again?
View, because that's pretty cool.
Okay. Okay. Can you turn around and put your back to the table? Other way. Yeah. Let me have that spoon from you. Okay, I want you to
see a little piece come
just
up.
Put your chin up a little bit and say E. Okay, I'm going to give you another teaspoon of that pudding. Just look straight ahead when you swallow that. Okay, can we just go all the way down?
Okay. Lights off, lights on.
Leave them off.
Okay. All right, right, so we are now looking at the pharynx. Well, we were looking at the pharynx. Let me take you to the top of page 85. Okay, so when you swallow, that's actually a two-part process. And whether or not you think about it, when you make the conscious decision to moisten up your food into a little ball called a bolus, you consciously decide, I'm done chewing this, and I'm going to push it to the back of my mouth. And the next time you eat something, think about this, because you are making that conscious decision that I'm done with this, going to swallow it now. You push it back and you begin to swallow. There are skeletal muscles back here in the pharynx that actually initiate the process of swallowing. And when you begin to swallow, those skeletal muscles contract and they help to push that food down toward the lower portions of your pharynx. Now, that voluntary phase is followed by an involuntary phase. And the involuntary phase is not skeletal muscle controlled, it's what? So skeletal muscles are voluntary. That is smooth muscle, yeah. So if you've ever eaten cheesy pizza that's really, really cheesy, you may have chewed up your little bolus of food, pushed it to the back of your mouth, and you said, okay, swallow. And then as you swallow, you're like, oh, but there's this piece still in my mouth. Wait, I want it back. You ever tried to pull the food back to your mouth? And you feel like, oh my God, I'm going to choke and die right this minute. Okay, so you're fighting, not the skeletal muscles, you're fighting the smooth muscles, right? So lucky you if you've never had to experience this, but you know, cheese pizza is bad for it because half of it goes down, the rest of it's in your mouth. You're like, I still want to chew it. No, 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 it's going down. Yeah, so if you try to pull it back, you're fighting the involuntary phase. It's called the pharyngeal esophageal phase. That's when it's no longer under your control. So basically, deglutition is swallowing. It's partly voluntary. That's the buccal phase. And the other half is involuntary. That's the pharyngeal esophageal phase. And that beyond, from that point, is beyond our control. All right, so then we travel down to the esophagus, and the only purpose of the esophagus is to take us from the mouth and pharynx below the diaphragm into the stomach. So we know that the esophagus is lined with this stratified squamous epithelial tissue. It's not dry, it's mucous membrane. And so why do you think we need stratified squamous on this particular organ's lining? Mucus, yeah, helps to let that food slide on down. Why not just put, say, simple squamous here?
You don't want to pass through.
Like if you swallow a chip that didn't chew up well.
Or a tear.
You're right, you don't want your esophagus torn open. We swallow all sorts of things that are rough, like bread and potato chips. So, yeah, you want to make sure that there's enough lining here to withstand that. In fact, every 2 to 3 weeks, our esophagus lining is repaired and replaced with brand new tissue. So, you know, sometimes people take those cancer drugs that cause like the esophagus and the digestive linings to be really irritated. What those drugs do is they decrease the rate of mitosis. And if you're not repairing that lining every 2 to 3 weeks, then that lining becomes thinner and it does burn to swallow and it becomes an irritated as you put things down the esophagus that could, you know, basically tear that thin lining. When you get down to the when you get in the esophagus, you're actually in a portion that's upper GI. We're sitting up above the diaphragm. And I wanted to make a point here. There is no serosa on the esophagus. You know, we're in the thoracic cavity, and there is only an internal mucosa. That's this part through which food, you know, will touch. There is a submucosa right up underneath. And then there is this dual layer of muscularis externa. But you'll notice there's no serous membrane on the outside surface, okay? And then once we travel down through the diaphragm, those organs that are lower digestive, they will now have serosa, okay? So that's one difference between esophagus and those other organs. All right, so what is the name of the opening in the diaphragm that the esophagus travels through?
Esophageal
hiatus, good. We normally think of the cardiac sphincter sitting in that neighborhood, but in reality, the actual dividing point between your esophagus and stomach is a tissue transition. So look at this here. It's a very abrupt transition between the esophagus with stratified squamous, and right there we change over into simple columnar. That now says we're in the stomach. So the catch is, if you happen to have a hiatal hernia, where you push a piece of your stomach up above the diaphragm, you may in fact have simple columnar tissue in that lining that's up above the diaphragm. Now, we ideally would not want to have a situation like this, because now what is gurgling up your esophagus?
Stomach acid.
Stomach acid, yeah. And of course that can cause like a Swiss cheese effect of your esophagus lining. We actually see ulcerations like you see here. Yeah. So even though there are stratified squamous lining the esophagus, the mucus here is not thick enough to protect against the acid coming from the stomach. So, you know, that's why we see these ulcerations here. So what are some things that can encourage a hiatal hernia to form? Well, females.
Your diet, like what you're eating, if it's really like red meats and stuff like that, or anything that can irritate a lot of your stomach.
That, if it's a large meal, yeah. Mm-hmm. So if you eat a large meal and the stomach says, I've got to push somewhere, and it's so it pushes up through that diaphragm opening, yeah. Why do females have to worry about this?
Pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. That'll do it. If you work in a job where you're picking up heavy stuff, you can oftentimes, you know, all that heavy lifting can force that stomach up. Obesity can do it as well. So there's a lot of things that can lead to having that diaphragm be breached by your stomach, having it pooch up into the thoracic cavity. How might you feel if you have a hiatal hernia? How might you feel? In pain.
Some people that have had them is like mimic heart pain.
Mimics heart pain, yeah.
Yeah, my older sister, she has a hiatal hernia, and she's super, super, like, skinny because she gets full really quick, and anytime she eats, her stomach hurts, and she always feels sick all the time, and so, like, she's been to the doctor, like, several times, and they know she's got that.
Wow.
But we don't know if she has, like, some other issues, because I know when she was younger, she had an underdeveloped stomach.
Oh, wow. No wonder she feels full quick right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, goodness. So that's probably a lifelong battle, is having that, like, acid reflux and stuff. Yeah.
Can I
have
our picture?
Can you ulcers?
Go back. Sure.
Yeah.
So, in fact, they're showing an open cardiac sphincter over here, so it looks like it's just a gurgling pipe that's letting acid come back up. So really the only function here is to transport food from the esophagus to the stomach. The esophagus has no other digestive or absorptive roles except to be a transport pipe. So it's a conduit and that's it. Once we get down to the stomach, we're starting to get into some more interesting territory. There's going to be some digestion that actually occurs here. So let's start by talking about the major regions first. At the very bottom of your page, you'll notice there are four primary regions. I know you guys know this from lab. Okay, so around this esophagus, this region is known as?
Cardia.
Good. On this side where you expand out?
Fundus.
Good. This main portion is called the?
Spine.
Good. And the terminal ending?
Pylorus.
Good. We do look at the stomach as a J-shaped pouch. This left-hand side kind of pokes over toward the left side of your abdominal pelvic cavity. And upon expansion, it can hold about how much food?
30 pounds.
Several pounds, yeah. Like a gallon's worth of food. So that's a lot that can force in there.
Wow.
When we're,
can eat my
yeah, really. That would be painful, yeah. I can't, you know, I look at a gallon of milk and I think, I can't eat that much. Especially not milk, right? So when you're empty, you see these folds of rugae, and they're there because the same reason your brain has those folds, it is to increase what?
Surface area.
Surface area, right. So we get more bang for our buck, more stretch there when we start to fill our stomach up. So back in the previous picture, there's actually two sphincters here to notice. I know you also know these from lab. The sphincter sitting at the top end between esophagus and stomach is what?
Cardiac sphincter.
Good, cardiac, and then between stomach and intestine?
Pyloric.
Pyloric sphincter, good. Now, we've talked about four layers for our digestive tract, an innermost mucosa, submucosa, muscularis externa, and then an outermost serosa. Of those four layers, which one do you think can contract and keep shut?
Muscularis
externa. Good. It is, in fact, that circular or ring-like muscle that keeps closed, but it's pressure-regulated. It's like a valve. If food sits on top, then those sphincters open and food can pass through, whether it's going down or whether it's coming back up. So if you're really, really full, then you can actually push on this cardiac sphincter, and then food can come back up the esophagus. All right, so it looks like we're ready to talk about the details of the stomach. This is over on the middle of page 86. What you couldn't see in the previous picture are lots and lots of tiny gastric pits that are inside your stomach. And those gastric pits are home to very specialized stomach cells. So before we talk about what all these cells do, I know it's getting to be around lunchtime, I wanted to ask you, if you could have your favorite lunch today, what would it be? What's that?
Chipotle.
Okay. What kind of meat?
Chicken.
Okay. Your favorite lunch. So we had chipotle with chicken, tacos.
Deli sandwiches.
Deli sandwiches. Any particular place you want to go? Okay. Any particular sandwich? Okay. Anybody else? Favorite lunch today? Nobody wants hot pizza right out of the oven? No. I've had people tell me in the past that say steak and baked potato was a favorite. Steak and baked potato.
That would be dinner.
That would not make dinner, yeah. Fried chicken, mashed potatoes and gravy. Pasta, yeah, I've heard pasta a lot. How about, say, hot chocolate cake with some icing and ice cream?
Double stuffed Oreos.
Hot chocolate chip cookies.
Ooh, hot chocolate chip cookies, yeah. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
That was my point. Okay, so what I'm doing is I'm messing with your brain, purposely messing with your brain. You may not normally be hungry at 11:30 in the morning, but you know what I'm doing is getting you to think about food. You know, maybe visualize it. You can even smell it. I can smell those chocolate chip cookies. Gonna have to swallow. Okay. So there's a nerve that comes from your brain that talks to your stomach. It works for the parasympathetic nervous system. It is your vagus nerve. Good. So what I'm doing is I'm getting you kind of into a mode where your brain is saying, hey, stomach, they're thinking about food. They're talking about food. It must be coming, right? So stomach, get ready. And so the vagus nerve tells these cells right here, these enteroendocrine cells, get ready. Get ready. That favorite lunch is coming down, right? Right? You're not messing with us. Okay, so that enteroendocrine cell now releases a hormone called gastrin. Gastrin makes sense because we're talking about the stomach. So when gastrin is released in response to vagus nerve activity, gastrin, like every other hormone, travels via the what? Bloodstream. Yeah, it travels the bloodstream. And here's something interesting. You know, normally hormones go and talk to somebody else, but this hormone comes back full circle and talks to a next door neighbor. So we're going to let that gastrin hormone travel through the bloodstream from your enteroendocrine cell. It's going to come back and talk to your parietal cells. How lazy, right? So your stomach, instead of just saying, hey neighbor, I've got a message, make your chemicals now, the hormone travels the bloodstream, comes back and tells those parietal cells to make two chemicals. Okay? So now the parietal cells make hydrochloric acid. And the second chemical that's made there is intrinsic factor. Okay. So your stomach may not be growling yet, because hormones take time, right? It is ready for lunch. Okay, so after a few minutes, you know, the parietal cells get the message. They start secreting hydrochloric acid. Acid, that's a clue. What are we going to do to stomach's pH?
Lower
it. Good. How low?
1 to 2.
Right. And on the pH scale, is that strongly acidic or weakly acidic?
Strongly.
That's very strong acidic, right? In fact, now you see why stomach acid causes ulcers in the esophagus. And in some people who have gastroesophageal reflux, it can cause problems with their vocal cords. It can gurgle that far up. It can also gurgle into your mouth and eat away your tooth enamel. Yeah, so pretty strong stuff. So that hydrochloric acid is important because it helps us to basically take big chunks of food and break them into smaller chunks. And especially that's good for hard to digest items like proteins. So we need a little extra kick, and that helps to give a little kick to those proteins. Also, we make something here called intrinsic factor. What is intrinsic factor important for making, or for absorbing rather? Vitamin B12, good. And where does B12 come from? What food groups? Meats, right. So you do not get B12 from plant matter. So if you're a strict vegetarian or a vegan, you do not get B12 through plant matter. You only get it through animal matter, like animal meat and eggs. Okay? So if people take an oral supplement of B12 pills, it is poorly absorbed through the digestive system, oddly enough, right? But if you take an injection, that's a better way, they say, in getting the B12 into your bloodstream. So B12 is important because it helps us make what specific blood cell? Red blood cells, good. All right, so there's a couple of blanks for us to talk about. B12 is important because it makes red blood cells. And if you don't have enough B12, what type of anemia might someone form?
Pernicious.
Pernicious, good. And if you need the spelling, pernicious is P-E-R-N-I-C-I-O-U-S. Sure. It's P-E-R-N-I-C-I-O-U-S. So let's do this from the top. If you're talking about food, if you smell food, if you even see food or even taste food, those things can turn on the vagus nerve. It stimulates the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve comes to the stomach, and the vagus nerve activates the release of a hormone from what type of cell?
Enteroendocrine.
Good. Enteroendocrine cell. Gastrin, like every other hormone, will travel the bloodstream. And it comes back full circle and talks to other cells in the stomach. What type of cells are targeted by gastrin?
Parietal cells.
Good, parietal cells. In response, those parietal cells make two chemicals. They are? Great, great. Which one of those will cause the stomach's pH to fall to around 1 or 2?
HCl.
Good, hydrochloric acid. And of course, intrinsic factor is important. It comes from our stomach, helps us absorb which B vitamin?
B12.
Good. And of course, B12 only comes in animals, not plants. Okay. So just kind of stop here and think for a minute. You know, sometimes people have acid reflux and they'll take, Nexium, they advertise themselves as that little purple pill. People take Prilosec. And those medications are specifically built to inhibit acid release from those parietal cells. And the reason that's important is it may help reduce the amount of acid that gurgles up your esophagus and may reduce your acid reflux. Here's why there's a downside of that. Thank you, computer. It's done. You know, every time I come to class, it does something different. Now it's telling me the news during PowerPoint shows. Great, right? Okay. So here's why taking a proton pump inhibitor like Prilosec or Nexium has a downside. We need that acid to help us activate an enzyme that breaks down proteins. The name of that enzyme is pepsin. Okay? And if you look on this list up here, you'll notice there's chief cells here that also secrete something called pepsinogen. Yeah. What does that gen suffix tell us? To create, to make, to begin, right? So pepsinogen is going to make pepsin. But the transformation from pepsinogen to pepsin requires acid. Ah, so if you take a proton pump inhibitor like Prilosec or Nexium and you decrease your acid production, how does that impact your transformation of pepsinogen to pepsin? It's going to be lower, right? And so what do pepsin molecules break down? That's an enzyme.
Proteins,
right. So if you're not breaking down your proteins as adequately as you should, what may happen to your feces?
Hard.
Hard and packed with proteins. So, there's a side effect, right? Okay, so they say that no medication comes without its side effects. Here's one that we would want to think about in terms of what happens if you take something like an acid or a proton pump inhibitor. Okay, so pepsinogen is made by chief cells. It's converted to active pepsin in response to acid in the stomach. Okay, why are these mucus cells up at the top of the picture? Why are they very important to our discussion? They secrete mucus, help the food pass through, good. And also mucus coats it, yeah. So without that thick coating of mucus, what would happen to the acid in your stomach? What would it eat? It eats your stomach lining, all right? Yeah, so that mucus is really important. We do not have those mucus neck cells and surface cells up in the esophagus. That is why we cannot handle all that acid gurgling back up. Okay, so that should take us down to renin, which is next. I'll come back to that in just a moment. So if you've ever wondered about making cheese at home, I have not. I don't know if you have ever thought about making cheese at home, but that's not been a goal of mine in life to make homemade cheese. But if you were interested in making homemade cheese, you need something like renin. So renin is a enzyme in our stomachs. It is active until around age 3 years old, and it helps us to specifically break down what kind of protein? Milk. Right. So when we're around age 3, most kids have stopped doing what?
Nursing,
yeah. Most kids by age 3 are no longer on a diet strictly of milk. They're probably no longer nursing, and even if they're bottle fed, they're probably being weaned off that bottle by around age 3. So the catch here is most of us don't make very much renin after age 3. Now, that means that as an adult, you probably have lesser ability to break down what?
Milk
proteins, right. I want to clarify here, there's also an enzyme called lactase. It breaks down a sugar in milk called lactose. That is a separate issue. Some people don't have very much of it, if any at all, and they are lactose intolerant. That is something different, though, from having less renin the older you get. So, yeah, the way that people learn to make cheese is they actually took renin from cow stomachs. I don't know who's doing this, right? You know, how they figured this out, but they took renin from cow stomachs, and they realized that it made the cheese set in a certain way, so it broke down those proteins. So that's, in fact, what they sell is something called renin. It makes cheese set the way you see here. So if you ever are interested.
So you said like children have more of it because of the milk. Now,
that's
is
right.
Is it for the mother's milk or for cow's milk?
I think it's for either one. I think the milk protein is broken down either, no matter the source.
Oh, okay. But it's better if it's the mother's.
They say it's easier to digest. I mean,
okay.
It's made for us. So.
So does that mean like technically you're not supposed to eat dairy products if our body can't break them down as easily?
What it seems is if you are routinely exposed to it, then your body knows to make it. But if you don't often have dairy products, especially milk, it seems that some people have a harder time digesting that because their body says,
right,
you don't,
I haven't been eating it,
right, so therefore I don't make these enzymes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, and out of all the food groups, it seems that dairy seems to really affect people as they get older. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And something interesting about dairy is it will increase your mucus production in your stomach. So if you're kind of feeling like I don't really feel very good, the last thing you want to put down is dairy. Yeah, cheese, milk, milkshakes, anything dairy based. So it can make you upchuck if you're already feeling on edge. All right, so let's go to the review there about middle of the page. All right, so it's a kind of a chain of command here. To turn on this whole activity in your stomach, the vagus nerve is the one that initiates control. The vagus nerve is going to be turned on by your brain, and it tells your stomach cells, enteroendocrine to be specific, to produce what?
Gastrin.
Gastrin, good. Make gastrin. Now, in response, gastrin travels the bloodstream. It comes back full circle and targets parietal cells. And those parietal cells make two chemicals. That blank on the left is hydrochloric acid. Okay, blank on the left is hydrochloric acid. Blank on the right is intrinsic factor. Blank on the left, HCl. Blank on the right is intrinsic factor. We know that hydrochloric acid, or at least having acid in your stomach, helps us transform what into what?
Protein.
That's it, right. Pepsinogen into pepsin. Good. Pepsinogen into pepsin on the left. And on the right, we know intrinsic factor is needed for the absorption of which vitamin?
B12.
Good, and that helps us make red blood cells. Just a bit of trivia for you today. If you do have air in your stomach and you start thinking about being hungry, those gastric juices are in there, your stomach's starting to grind, it's in preparation for what may come down. And if it's growling, it's actually air that's in your stomach being propelled into your small intestine. If you can burp out that air, you can eventually stop that growling noise that you hear in your stomach, because it is the air that contributes to growling in your small intestine, not your stomach. So if you don't burp out the air, then it continues on and it comes out the other end. So eventually it's taken care of, right? So pretty cool pictures here of those gastric pits. You know, you've got a pretty thick mucosa lining, and these deep cavities are what we think of as the gastric pits. They're lined with all those specialized cells among those simple columnar epithelial tissue cells. So it's a pretty diverse environment down there in terms of what we have to produce all those chemicals. Lots of mucus neck cells here. Got to have that thick mucus to maintain the integrity, the lining of that stomach. Okay, so let me fast forward just to here. This is actually near the bottom of your page. And, you know, we really haven't talked so far about much chemical digestion. A lot of what's going on here is simply just grinding up the food. There is a third layer of the muscularis externa that helps to assist with the peristalsis and grinding. The only hydrolysis we've talked about is breaking down proteins. In fact, if you break a protein down, what building blocks do you create?
Amino acids.
Amino acids, good. And the types of enzymes we use here are renin, that specifically works on milk proteins, and pepsin. What pH is required for pepsin to work?
A very low pH.
Very low pH, good. Very acidic environment. Got a couple of blanks to fill in near the very bottom. Alcohol and aspirin. Those are the two things that are typically limited for absorption here in the small stomach. Okay, so no wonder people have alcohol and empty stomach and it hits the bloodstream, right? Because there's no food in there to help slow the absorption. All right, how about questions so far? Top of page 87, we've actually kind of done this already, but now we're going to officially name the phases. When we think about the control of your stomach, we think about the vagus nerve communicating between your brain and your stomach. There's actually some research going on to figure out, you know, how this communication takes place and what other things is your vagus nerve tattling to your brain about. So they have actually found, you know, that if you are full, it takes some time for the vagus nerve to feed back that information to your brain. There's also hormones and chemicals in your bloodstream that have to be absorbed by your brain, or at least detected by your brain to know that you're full. So, you know, we're not going to be instantly, I'm full, I'm done this minute. We can often take 10 or 15 minutes to fully realize that full feeling has set in. So vagus nerve is the main communicator between brain and stomach, and the hormone that primarily controls stomach activities is gastrin. What type of cell releases gastrin in the stomach? Yeah, the E word, right? Enteroendocrine, that's it. So what I did by asking you about your favorite meal or favorite lunch today was to activate your cephalic phase. That is your head phase. So I was messing with you, trying to get your brain to start thinking about time to eat, right? And so seeing food, talking about it, smelling it, or even tasting food can turn on this cephalic phase. That increases the vagus nerve's activity, and that increases gastrin release into the bloodstream. So which nervous system branch are we working with right now? Parasympathetic or sympathetic?
Parasympathetic,
good. If you're cranked into sympathetic mode, what do you think happens to the cephalic phase? Yeah, turn it off, right? So if you have just come back from exercising, you're probably not hungry, you know? If you are stressed out, that can inhibit the vagus nerve. You know, if you're excited, those kinds of things can all shut off the vagus nerve activity to the stomach. Well, once you actually start eating food, we now progress into a gastric phase. In this phase, do you think we want to encourage the stomach secretions or shut them down?
Encourage,
right. So we, in fact, will tell the stomach, good job, keep it up, keep making those secretions, because food is entering the stomach during this time that we're actively eating. Now, when you get to the point where you've finished your meal and you're no longer currently eating, we now enter what's called an intestinal phase. There's a reflex here called the enterogastric reflex. And like all reflexes, or most reflexes, this one is automatic. What do you think we're going to tell the stomach to do at this point? Keep it up, doing a good job, or thank you, you're done. Thank you, you're done. Yeah. So this time we tell the stomach, hey, show's over. There is no need to continue pumping all of these chemicals into the stomach. And we're going to actually slow down the stomach activities during this intestinal phase. The reason for that is, where is the food now going? Going into the small intestine. And if you think about the size here, if you do have a stomach that can hold a gallon of food, wow, think about the diameter of your small intestine, about thumb size, right? You do not want your stomach to say, here you go, here's all of this food at one time, because that's called a dumping syndrome. Guess where the food ends up? Dumping syndrome. In the toilet. Yeah. So, no joke, it is called dumping syndrome, yeah. So, the stomach says, okay, I get your message, I'll slow down my activity, because if it keeps pushing toward the small intestine, we can't really absorb the food that's coming into the small intestine that quickly. So, what we want to do is tell the stomach, okay, slow down the secretions, you know, we're only going to accept about a teaspoon's worth of food at a time. That allows for us to adequately handle it in the small intestine. So during this time period, there's a hormone here that's released called gastric inhibitory peptide, or GIP for short. What does that shut off? Gastrin secretions. And if you shut down gastrin secretions, what else also follows suit? acids. Don't make your acids anymore, right? And if you don't make your acids, you're no longer converting what into what?
Pepsin into pepsin,
right. So basically it's like we're packing up, we're done, you know, we're finished with this job. So GIP is one of the hormones that tells the stomach, okay, show's over, stop, you know, stop making all these secretions. So when we're emptying food into the small intestine, it has already spent around 4 to 6 hours being digested in your stomach. It's going to spend another 3 to 6 hours being digested and absorbed in your small intestine. If you think about this, if you eat breakfast at 8 o'clock in the morning, you're probably getting hungry around 12 to 2. And between 12 and 2, the stomach has fully emptied, and now we're going to spend from, say, around 12 o'clock to 6 o'clock traveling through the small intestine. And by that point, all the nutrients that are going to be absorbed will be absorbed into the bloodstream, and that's it. So that's why we want to take our time. Don't let the food rush through the small intestine. We don't want to, you know, minimize how much of those nutrients we can absorb. Okay, so which two phases favor stomach secretions? Cephalic and gastric. And which step inhibits stomach secretions?
Intestinal,
right. That reflexes back, inhibits stomach activity. Good. Okay, so let me take you to this quick video. I don't need music, do we? Okay, so kind of a weird looking there. That's the stomach actually performing peristalsis. And here comes a wave. You can see the contraction going down toward the pyloric region. And it's amazing you don't actually feel that. And I'm not hungry anymore, right?
So in there, that's the stomach?
That is the stomach, yeah.
So this part is the sphincter?
They're actually pointing it at the pyloric sphincter, which is down in that opening, down in there.
Okay.
Yeah, and so the waves are coming across and pushing that food toward the pyloric sphincter. Okay. All right, so down there near the bottom of your page, I've got a couple of blanks to fill in for you. I did mention that food stays in the stomach around 4 to 6 hours. Okay, and then down below, you've got another blank. Some types of meals that will slow the stomach's emptying. What do you think? Types of meals that slow your stomach's emptying. Big meals, small meals?
Big
meals, definitely. Protein-rich meals. Also empty more slowly.
Like McDonald's.
Yeah, like fried chicken. Mm. The stuff we think that is
delicious.
Yeah. What you think is more satisfying is usually the thing that the worst stuff for us, right?
That's great.
So that's why it can make you feel like candy, because it's just sitting there.
It is sitting there, yeah. In fact, if you have something like fried chicken with the grease floats to the top, and when that wave of peristalsis comes, the grease sits and it's the last thing emptied.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So I was watching this video, and it's called Obesity Postmortem. They cut the lady open, and the fat, her adipose tissue, is still greasy.
Really? Oh, wow.
And she had been soaked in, you know, everything, so... He said it was still greasy.
Was that on Netflix? Mm-hmm. I saw that. I have to watch that.
What's the name of it?
It's what?
Obesity Postmortem. It talks about being unhealthy from the inside instead of the outside. It shows all the fat around the organs. It squeezed adipose tissue from within her lungs and
Whoa.
Everything. Yeah. It was really good.
I did not know it would get in your lung tissue like that.
I didn't either. When they were cutting her open, like, she kept cutting through his bag, cutting through his bag, and she was like, "This is crazy."
Wow.
You can see it on her knees.
I'll have to watch that.
And she died from like a heart problem, and they were talking about like the consequences of having a heart problem internally.
Wow. Wow. Must have been, like you say, morbidly obese, so wow.
Yeah, she was like 5'2", and she was like over 2 meters sometimes. She was a short lady, but she kind of big.
Wow. Bottom of your page down there. Changing topics completely, right? Gastritis can come from any kind of stomach inflammation or irritation. Bacteria and viruses can do it. So can food poisoning. So oftentimes we don't know the source of it, so we just say gastritis is a catch-all term. Now, the thing is, if we have an irritated stomach lining, we don't want to put something in there that's going to further irritate it. So a BRAT diet is recommended. Notice again, no dairy products here. These are things that are typically easy to digest. Milk products tend to increase mucus production, and if you already feel on edge, like you're going to be sick to your stomach, then it can encourage, you know, further vomiting. So BRAT diet is the favored thing right now for upset stomachs. Just a couple of things down there near the bottom of your page. Let's see. Gastric ulcers is next. I think my PowerPoint froze again. PowerPoint's not been nice to me lately. Okay, so down at the bottom, we've got gastric ulcers, things like that. Let's talk about those for just a moment. You know, back in the 70s and 80s, people oftentimes were told that if they had stomach ulcers, it was stress-induced, and, you know, to change their lifestyle, which probably won't hurt if you're stressed, you know, anyway. But nowadays they understand that a lot of the ulcers people experience are in fact a bacterium called Helicobacter pylorus. What region do you think they primarily affect in the stomach?
Pyloric
region, right? That's that region down here where the food is pushed before it enters the small intestine. The problem with having a bacterial infection here is we breach that stomach lining. So you'll notice in this picture they actually show bleeding in the stomach. And unfortunately, that can lead to discolored stools, and if a person vomits, they may be vomiting up blood from that bleeding ulcer. And likewise, that acid now has the opportunity to irritate and inflame the underlying tissue layers, and that's what we want to avoid. So this is a really common bacterium. About 70% of us walk around with Helicobacter. For many people, it causes no problem. For those who have an active infection, they may have terrible stomach pains, especially when their stomach is empty. It is so common that you can pick it up from drinking out of a water fountain. Mm-hmm. So,
wow.
And now I've ruined the water fountain, right?
Yeah.
So, but it is something that a lot of people do carry without any kind of problem. Now, you can have a biopsy and detect Helicobacter that way. You may also have a blood test that can confirm Helicobacter. But since it's a bacterial infection, what is a likely treatment for it?
Antibiotics.
All right, so that's oftentimes what they'll do here. Let's talk about weight loss. So there's a lot of different surgeries out there for weight loss. This one here is called a gastric bypass surgery. And you'll notice they cut off a big piece of the stomach and the small intestine, and they leave those pieces intact inside the body, but they bypass them. So they actually take this little teeny tiny pouch of a stomach and they hook it to a lower piece of your intestine. I know we haven't talked about the intestine yet, but this dramatically reduces what you can absorb. This also dramatically reduces what your stomach contributes to the digestive process. What do you think happens to, say, protein digestion? And not gonna have very much, right? How about your red blood cell population? How is it affected? decreased, right? Because you're not absorbing vitamin
B12.
Yeah, no B12. So people who have this kind of surgery do take handfuls of vitamins to maintain enough absorption into their bloodstream.
So they have to take them for the rest of their life like that?
Yeah.
So that's kind of, it could be a thing for them, right? Is this for people who are like 100 pounds?
Well, not like 800 pounds. They try to get them to lose weight down to a more reasonable weight, and then they'll give them this option at that point. I think I read like BMIs between 30 and 37, they're offering things like this to people in that body mass index range.
The unused portion, what's happening to that? It's just sitting there decaying?
In that particular situation, they leave it inside. And it still works.
So, when they have this surgery and it goes back, is the seam that's coming open? Because this is separated. So
yeah. If they do try to reverse it, then that's what they try to knit back together. But otherwise, that whole piece is left inside. I had a stomach years ago, I had a student years ago. I'm hungry, apparently. They left it in her, and they put a tube to let the gases out because it would still growl when she was hungry.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That stuff isn't safe, is it?
It is not safe, no. I've heard all sorts of horror stories. After teaching through the years, people always share horror stories of, you know, things that have happened.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people. I saw this one girl had it,
yeah.
And she was
so she hadn't. It hasn't done her any good.
I thought
she was still waiting.
She stretched that pouch.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like the seam must be bust where she can get something happen. I don't know.
That's very dangerous. Yeah.
My aunt suffered from it, and they you're on a special diet. Right after you have the surgery, like you're on strictly fluids, then it turns into like applesauce or pudding or something, and then after a while, like you're on the special diet for a long time,
mm-hmm.
then you can start eating certain things, but the dumping can happen when you eat sugars and stuff like that. Like it's a very serious thing. Like it's been a year now. I mean, she's losing the weight, but yeah, it's not a walk in the park, and she does have to take vitamins for the rest of her life and stuff like that. And then you get really thirsty all the time, but that water fills you up, so you have to take those supplements in order to maintain the vitamins stuff that you need for your life.
It's life-changing.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very serious, you need to make sure that's what you really want. But hers was a health thing. Like, her blood pressure started to increase. She didn't want to be on blood pressure medication. My family has diabetes running through it, so she wanted to avoid that, and that can help with that part. Because if you're overweight, you're more prone to having diabetes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Lauren.
Why do they still leave the stomach in there?
I don't know why they leave that pouch. Maybe it's more trouble to take it out.
Maybe it's more trauma to the body.
It may be. Because it's all in that mesentery, and you'd have to break that, and the pancreas sits behind it. But in this one here, I understand they do take out that piece of the stomach.
The sleeves.
So
the
sleeves,
yeah.
With the
stomach,
they take out.
I had somebody last fall semester, and she said they took out her stomach through her belly button.
Oh, that sounds fun.
That does sound fun. Yeah, you have no backup plan. Yeah. I think it's the size of the meal that matters for reducing how much you can stretch. Yeah. That's, I think, the thing is smaller meals will shrink it. Yeah. This is something they're using nowadays also. No cutting here, but what they do is they put a little band around the stomach, and that now becomes your eating pouch. And the doctor can control this access port. You don't go home and just go, I'm hungry, I'm going to fill me up today and push a button. So they can, in the doctor's office, change the diameter of that band, let you eat more or let you eat less. The dangerous thing is I've heard people, you know, they're really hungry, they burst the band, and then now there's problems.
How about when people have children, like they get pregnant? I mean, does it not affect?
Ooh, that would be, yeah, because all of that's pushed out of the way.
It pushes everything up. What do you think that would be?
You'd think that'd be bad.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And you would want your nutrients to nourish the pregnancy.
The baby.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Just like it would
be. Yeah.
I guess they'd have to take that off.
They
would have to take it out. Right?
I would think so. I couldn't imagine that being safe.
No, that would be a good idea.
Yeah. We've decided that pregnant that comes off. Yeah.
I didn't worry about it when I was pregnant. I ate
I think we all do.
That's my game. 42 pounds
for
one child,
36
for the other.
It's funny eating, right? All right, we're going to start with page 88 on Thursday. How about that? 88 on Thursday.